So I'd also like to thank Molly for inviting me to this wonderful condensed meeting of amazing people, actually. And it's very nice also to follow Amaury. So I'm going to talk, I think the things I'm going to talk about actually, you know, might reflect some of the things that he was talking about from a theoretical point of view, and I'm basically going to show data or places where we can get data and which raise questions that maybe would fit with that theory, and it would be interesting to pursue that. So I'm going to talk about Lake Malawi cichlids, which are one of the most dramatic radiations in vertebrates. So, you know, we heard about maybe pulses of speciation, and we know that there are evolutionary radiations that happen, in which arguably a large fraction of the creation of new species takes place. And this is a sort of textbook case of that. And you know, this is a poster with, can I do this? Yeah, I can. With examples of lots of different species, enormous variation in morphology, actually in size. There are things, you know, this big down to tiny little fish. In diet, where they live, ecology, all sorts of traits. And these have happened amongst Haplochroma and cichlids in all the Great Lakes of East Africa, and in fact there are cichlids in across Africa, but particularly in the Great Lakes, there have been these radiations of hundreds of species, and in Lake Malawi, that's taken place within the last million years. We estimate probably within of the order of 500,000 years. So, you know, this provides a great system in order to look at how things separate or become different, and also how they maintain their differences, because they're all sitting in the same lake. It's a big lake, but as we'll see, things are very accessible to each other. Okay, so people have worked on this system for a long time, but it's clear as genomic sequencing came along that we could now get it at the substrate, the genetic substrate of what's going on. And we started a few years ago with Malan Malinsky, who's here, and sequenced a representative set of species, 72 species, and there are a few of them illustrated here, and this is a neighbor joining tree of the genomes. And the first message is that they're genetically very close. So here we see the distribution in gray of diversity within species. It's about 0.1%, to 0.15%. That's, you know, the same approximately as in humans, relatively low for vertebrates. But in the tan color, you see the divergence between pairs of species, the distribution of that. And that overlaps the diversity distribution and it is within a factor of 2, basically. So if we look at the tree, we have very long branches because actually that's reflecting, and in fact there are multiple individuals of some species there reflecting the diversity. And the FST between species varies at the bottom end, things that are called species. We can discuss what should be called species, from 5% up to 65%. And that's comparable to what you see within single species of some species like zebrafish. So under a sort of classical biological species concept, you can cross them with effort. They can produce fertile offspring. So they wouldn't be regarded as separate species. On the other hand, they are so different from each other, and they clearly maintain their identities, their separation in the wild, in places where they can meet each other, that, you know, we can be interested in what's keeping them apart. And argue, you know, a key question, which we're going to come back to at the end, is, are these in the process of separation from each other, or is this some sort of stable equilibrium where they're dynamically in some relationship where they keep separate identities and population identities, but are still exchanging material? I think those are key questions. And of course, you know, what is behind that is that genetic separation is a gradual process. It takes time. So people want to think about speciation as a process going forward in time, and somehow think that there's some, you go from one species to two and there has to be some event, some magic happens at some point. But in reality, individuals are related by different amounts, and that happens at differently at different loci along the genome. So there's a tree that relates things at a single point in the genome, but that tree within a population, of course, varies as you go along the genome. That's due to recombination. And that the depth of that is, I put here, the order of a million years. It depends on the demography and the various other things, but actually that's a good order of rule of thumb. And so, you know, if things are separated by more than a million years, then you have gene trees within species, and they're well separated from each other, and so we have an overall species tree. If it's on the shorter term, you might still have, on average, species A being closer to species B, but just because of the depth of the separate individual gene trees, you can have incomplete lineage sorting, where this individual is actually closer to species C individuals than to species A individuals at that locus. And you can also have gene flow, where hybridization could still occur, and you can have gene flow after, in some sense, separation. And of course, there's a sort of blur between these two things. So there's a key question, how important is this process? And we just heard from Amaury, you know, there's theories about them facilitating and being very important in speciation. And there are multiple examples of those in cichlids, some of which I'm going to talk about, and there's others I'm not going to cover. So if we look at the gene trees, we see in amongst our sequenced individuals, we built here separate trees for 1,500 regions with 5,000 variants each. Every single one is different from each other. They form a huge cloud like this. There's some sort of overall structure. So there is an average, and we can draw the average here in dark black for a subset of the species that represent these groups, which were identified a priori as ecological subtypes, and you know, the genera pretty much sort out in amongst these groups, the taxonomic genera. But you can see there's a lot of variation even between those. And the red tree here actually is the mitochondrial tree, which is very non-congruent to the average genomic tree. Okay, so there's a sort of side point there. We can look at the average distance of each tree from the mean nuclear tree, and there's a distribution, and the mitochondrial tree is an outlier in that. So from my perspective, at least when things are close, mitochondrial trees are not good ways of thinking about species relationships. So that's all, you know, about ILS, or at least that still could be accounted for by ILS. Do we see any evidence for subsequent gene flow on top of that? So there's a very nice test that Nick Patterson introduced in the context of looking at human population relationships. These are D statistics, or it's a set of F tests. The F4 test corresponds to this. And essentially what you did is look at a case where you have a pair of species or populations which you think are sisters or are closely related, and you've got an outgroup, and then you've got a more distant population, and you're asking, is one of these ones which should be, which you think of as being a sort of symmetric sister, actually more closely related to this one here, this sort of test group? And the archetypical example for this is in humans, for thinking about Europeans and Africans as modern humans, or out of Asia, out of Africa in population, and Neanderthals, and say chimp as an outgroup. And then what the test does is it looks at variants which differ between the outgroup and the sort of test species or population, and which are polymorphic also between the two in-groups. And for those variants which fit this pattern, there's two ways around they could be. They could either be ABBA or BABA. So this is sometimes called the ABBA-BABBA test. Okay. And assuming there was no flow here, this should be symmetric. The numbers you see of both of those should be the same. And since these are variants which happened at least as far ago as here, this actually is independent of changes in branch length and quite a lot of demographic assumptions as well. So it's so the test is essentially just to take the difference between these two and normalize it. And in this case, you get a significant result that's strongly significant because there are a lot of such variants across the genome. So even small effects can be significant. Okay, so what happens if we do this for Lake Malawi, where we use as an outgroup a Tanganyika cichlid, I think. Well, we get, so this is the Z-score, and this is the admixture ratio, which under certain assumptions, which don't always hold, and actually one should take with a grain of salt, but a sort of a first stab at the actual fraction of admixture, the fraction of admixture. What we see is this huge slew of very strongly significant results, including at quite significant admixture ratios. So, you know, under a pure ILS model, this would you would essentially have none of this. So it's clear that there's been a lot of things which either come from population structure or from gene flow. And that happens both within groups. These are within in-group distributions. There's substantial amounts of significant flow and also between groups. Okay. So, you know, there's further sort of evidence for this sort of thing. In fact, we can start looking. And I should say, you might say, oh, well, it's all a gemisch, you know, it's all a mess and everything is mixed up. That's actually not true. There is an overall phylogeny. And in fact, the groups are consistent by many average measures. So if we look at PCA plots, so specific, probably the sort of oldest, strongest signal comes from looking at this group of species here, which are the most close relatives. So this is the sort of first split in the tree, and then this splits from these groups. But there's this spread here, a cline in this direction. These are deep water specialists, open deep water fish. And these are benthic. They sit on the bottom of the lake, but they're sort of shallow and deep versions. And the deep versions are you know, in the direction of the deep water diplotaxodon. And we can, in fact, see that very kind of clear directional spread here. And if we look at variants which have excess non-synonymous divergence across the lake, and we look for things in the top percentage there, and there's a significant number which have actually a positive, have more non-synonymous than synonymous variants, the significant number of genes. So this is a histogram over genes. There's enrichment in a set of functionalities which we know are associated with water depth in fish, particularly the visual system and the oxygen transport globins and so on. And in those, we find that the deep water benthics, which are phylogenetically distant from diplotaxodon, but ecologically live in similar environments, actually share the same haplotypes in both. This is a visual processing gene, and they're also actually opsins that show this pattern. So it looks as though there has been potentially selection on gene flow that's allowed traits to move. Okay, so yes, that's just a so that's all on a sort of big scale. Can we actually see this in action? What's going on a fine scale? So this is a study with George Turner and Martin Jenner, who we've done a lot of the sample collection at one location in Chilumba, which is in the north of the lake. So it's a large lake. It's like 700 kilometers long. There is space for lots of things to happen. But at this location, there's a set of reefs and small islands and reefs offshore, which are separated by several kilometers from each other. And these fish, these Mbuna-type fish, live in rocky reefs. And really, that's their specialists. That's where they live. They don't venture out that far. And you get a lot of local specialization. And There's this type of fish here, Melandia zebra. Many people, this is a sort of standard Malawi cichlid that people who have fish tanks and may have examples of. But there are different morphs and forms of that in this area. And in particular, these ones, these Amiltos ones that have a red streak on the dorsal fin and find zilberi. And you find both of those types at all of these locations. And so we can study relationships between those species and see whether they're really staying separated. So we do see these together. And in fact, you can see in mating preference studies, which I'm not going to show you, there is mating preference of the females to their parental, their species type. Okay, so we took about 200 fish from this system, and this is an overall tree. You can't see it all, it's too detailed. And I guess the simplest assumption might have been that this is the derived form, because this looks more like this, but actually it's more complicated than that, as things tend to be. What seems to happen is that the fine zilberi from three different locations sit nested within the Amiltos species. So these are actually all closer to one of the locations of the Amiltos than that whole group is to the other one. So if we look at a PCA plot of all these samples, this is kind of reflecting that. So this is PC1 and PC2, about 4% and 2% of the variance. This is the outgroup one, separated out on PC1. These are the three fine zilberies, and the Luino reef one, Amiltos, is a bit in this direction, so it has some Amiltos-like qualities, but is, you know, is clearly closer to all of these. And in PC2 and PC3, very nicely separate out everything except for the Amiltos umfanga, the M version, which sits in the middle. So these are the three fine zilberies. But if you look at them, there are outliers in each of those collections. So this was a collection of what appeared phenotypically all the same from one place. And here there's pairs of outliers, which might reflect that there's some sort of gene flow going on, and these are some type of hybrid or not fully resolved hybrid. So if we look at those more closely, this is an admixture plot, as Jonathan introduced. These are the different groups, but you can see that they're these single, you know, odd occasional individuals who look a bit different. And interestingly, after we observed this and we went back and looked at this pair of fish here in this group that look different, which are actually these two here, which belong to that group. So phenotypically, you can see slight differences. So the two differences that, so these have lost their color because they're formaldehyde fixed, but this dorsal dark stripe is shorter here than is typical for this species. It runs further along the dorsal fin. And also, these fish are all a little bit deeper in body shape, and these are a bit narrower. So there's, you know, it does appear that there's some variation there in this population towards possibly other species. Okay, whoops, wrong direction. And there's some evidence also in this system for weak local gene flow between species, so that the fine zilberi in Luino reef are closer to the Amiltos in Luino reef than the other fine zilberi are. And there's a D-test here that's significant. It has a Z-score of about 4.5 or 5. Okay, so there is some evidence, and actually it's quite a few. You know, we have tens of individuals, and if there's really hybrids at this level of a few, how are they keeping themselves separate is a question. And this is actually quite it's a rich system. It's interesting to pursue what's going on, but we don't know. It's in the open lake. We don't know really everything else. We haven't got samples of everything that's there, so it's hard to follow. So actually, I'm going to finish off with by looking at going back to a system that we started in, which is a kind of model system for the whole of Lake Malawi. It's a crater lake, Masoko, which is just north of Malawi, and there it's about 800 meters across, much smaller. It's a volcanic crater lake. There's a series of them, as you can see in this picture. There's a couple of pictures here. There are actually, I think, three species of fish there, but one of them has separated out, apparently, or there's two morphs. So these are a yellow morph, which is like this sort of standard generalist Acetotelapia calyptera. And then there's a morph which appears deeper, which is a bit different in body shape and various other characteristics, and is blue, when in the males are colored blue. And and it looks like on a tree of all this species, this lake forms one clade. There's the blues are kind of nested within that as a group. Okay. So we've actually been collecting more fish from this lake and phenotyping them and characterizing them in more detail than in the original paper. And so Hannah Munby has been processing that data. She's been a master's student. And here's a PCA of this system. And the first PC has about 2.5% of the variance, so significantly more than the second one. And what we see is on the PCA, so we're coloring samples here by three colors, but where they were caught, shallow, intermediate, or deep. And firstly, we see this strong cluster of fish, all of whom were caught deep. And they effectively look like a sort of separate population. And then what we see is this other type, which is the more like the generalist fish that one finds in all neighboring lakes and rivers. There's a main cluster here, and some of these are caught at different depths, including intermediate depths, and a handful at deep depths. So it looks like these do venture down occasionally and come back. And then, you know, there's a smear of stuff in between, which includes fish, which progressively, as you go leftwards, are found deep, but are not, but still, you know, are found at mixed depths. So it looks like potentially we've got a situation where there's some specialized, there's a general form that prefers shallow but is can sort of venture. And there's a specific specialized set who never venture out of the shallow, out of the deep water. So this is from Milan's original paper. If you do an FST scan across the genome, one sees these islands that Amaury was talking about. The overall FST is about 4%. You see clusters of highly differentiated regions. Nothing is fixed different. Maybe that's consistent with there being some hybridization. This is a sort of control. It's a comparison to another lake. And there's really nothing significant in that comparison. So there's about 50 to 100. It depends how you define them. You can do GoTEM analysis, and also you find things involved in vision there and various other things that I'm going to rush through. These do look a separate group. If you look at body shape, here's a plot of body shape, the first principal components of body shape against genotype, and this cluster here is different in that respect. And so we started, you know, trying to find loci involved in that process. But what I actually want to talk to you about, which I think might help us understand what's going on, is this recent study by Julia Trautzi with Martin Jenner, where they've started looking at at scales, a specific set of large scales along the lateral side of the fish. And you can count these rings and use them as a proxy for age. Now, they're not years, because these fish are not living as long as there are rings. But we're working on the basis that we can use those as shared proxies for essentially growth rate by standardizing the number of the count of rings to the length of the fish. And when we do that, if we take the genotype PC1, we see that the growth rate, standard length over age, has this, you know, pronounced U-shaped shape, suggesting that there's a fitness deficit in the intermediate genotype. And we can fit a quadratic selection coefficient to that, or Martin has, comes to 0.8, which is as seen in, this is a classic review of these coefficients, and they're all typically around 0.1 or low value. So this is right at the extreme looks at very strong measure. So, and furthermore, you might say, well, maybe this is just where they're caught, the genotype, the intermediate genotype ones tend to be caught at the intermediate depth, and maybe that's a bad place to live compared to, you know, not so it's reflecting that. But as we saw actually in the original plot here, the separation isn't complete by depth, certainly in this group, and we can actually consider the mean of that as a function of depth on this axis or genotype on this axis. And it's very clear that the dip is much stronger as a function of genotype than it is as a function of depth of being caught. Now, of course, we don't know that they spent their whole life at that depth. This is where they were caught. So there are caveats involved. But the suggestion is that maybe they are hybridizing in this case. And maybe they're hybridizing and then there's preferential hybridization back to the generalists which is why you get things in the middle here and in this direction, but there's actually sort of a gap between them and here. But there is selection against this. So there's a selection system against this, but it's a system that's leaky and allowing things through. So I'm going to finish there. I think it's a very, you know, there's a really rich system here. And one thing I want to do from my experience in human genetics, where there's been this tremendous effect of people generating large data sets and then other people being available for people to use. So all the things that Jonathan and Guy talked about have been, you know, based on these big resources. And so we've now actually got 2,500 fish sequenced, 15x. And so I'm hoping, with at least some initial publication of that, to get that out there so that all the theoreticians in this audience who have all these great ideas can look and maybe extract more about what's going on in this system. But I think a key question is, how do these things stay separate? I mean, you might think the first question is, how do they separate? There is some ecological, it's not all in sympatry, there is some sort of allopatric quality about this situation. But it seems like there is gene flow and quite a lot of it, and we've seen that a lot. And so how do you things keep separate? We have this fitness, you know, suggestion. I mean, this is a picture here, actually, of them in the wild, and it's proof it's not a fish tank. There's a hippo in the picture. luckily, I've never seen a hippo in the while I've been in the water there. So are we seeing a transitional state, you know, towards full separation? Is this a process of speciation, or is it a stable equilibrium? Is this the sort of, do we get this huge variety of cichlids because they manage to keep themselves to do this business of separating out key loci that are involved in the face of gene flow? And is the initial separation due to some sort of sympatric sorting out of these properties? Or does it require there to be gene flow in to kind of kick things into a new type, which then can establish an equilibrium? So I think there's a whole set of questions like that. And I want to finish there, and I want to thank Milan, who was now a postdoc with Walter Salzberger, Hannes Svardal, who as postdoc has now got a job at Antwerp, and Margarita and Tyler and Hannah still in the group working on the cichlids and other people working on other things. But in particular, it's important to thank the collaborators who really have worked for a long time in these systems. So George Turner, and colleagues at Bangor, and Martin Jenner, and colleagues at Bristol. And the group who actually got me into all this was Eric Misker at Gordon Institute, and Amelia, who now has a lab in zoology. So thanks.